Hello, I'm Teresa Ayers.
And I'm Janet Gallen, and we are
the Love Letter Squad.
And we are here today to present another story and love letter and a tribute to the human spirit. And I'm just going to introduce our guest right away. It's David Refkin, who is a musician. And by the way, may I just say, the host of one of my favorite radio shows of all time on Ragtime.
Here on KUSF.
Yes. So, David, you start and just talk about yourself musically and growing up. And
well, I am a musician in a full-time sense, at least mentally. In these days, being a musician, being a practicing musician, making money is kind of a meager way to operate, but I still do it. I chose to take violin lessons when it was offered in elementary school to be part of the school orchestra.
What drew you to it?
A list came around, said pick an instrument if
oh,
you want to be in it, and I
really?
Said, okay, I'll do that.
Okay.
Almost arbitrarily, almost randomly. And so I stuck with the violin, and I became very good at it, and I was given a couple of very good private teachers during my junior high school years.
Where was this?
In Rhode Island. So I eventually decided somewhere in high school that I really did want to be a professional musician, not even really fully understanding what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
But I had other interests, too.
And it came to were the, what?
Well, in mostly recording engineering and that sort of thing, audio engineering. And so it came to the point when I was about a junior and I was thinking, okay, I got to apply to schools. I seriously was thinking of getting a degree in recording engineering or something like that. They didn't really have degree programs at that point, but that's how I was thinking. And so I was one day standing in my living room with applications to music schools in one hand and to these audio engineering schools in the other hand, and I really was sort of physically weighing and saying, well, no, this is an inside decision. It's about me, and I am a musician first. Anything else I want to do would be extra, but I am a musician all the way through. So applied to music schools. I was accepted to them, and I went to New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. Probably the happiest decision I ever made in my life.
Okay, tell us all about that.
Well, I'll give you the overlying framework first, which simply is this. Within the first week I was there, something really wonderful happened. A few days before graduation, something else even more wonderful happened.
What?
And these are related and tie together the entire 4 years and the rest of my life. This is a school for musicians. It's a small school. It's a college of music, but it's one of the most prestigious schools of music in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's an honor to be able to be accepted to go to school there. I was filling a spot that maybe 10 people in the world could fill that year, you know, violinists that they were recruiting for their teachers and for their programs. So, you know, I worked really hard to get in there, but it takes just about the same amount of intensity and work to get out. You have to
be up to a
certain kind of standard to graduate, too.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of work. But I was in a school for 4 years with people, as I say, of my own kind. It was just musicians, just practicing full-time musicians, just like myself. I had never been in an environment like that, and not since. I always say the four happiest years of my life were in that school.
And everybody's loving it as much as you are.
I hope so. I mean, there are ups and downs like anything else, and some people don't make it to the finish line. But the people you meet there, the teachers and the students, are all inspiring. So the first week I was there, there was a friend of mine who was also in school there, who happened to be from Rhode Island. He was in there a year or two ahead of me. He said there was this job opening in the audio studio, the audio department, to record concerts and fix equipment, learn how to do audio things. It's, wow, that's what I wanted
to do
anyway.
So you got to do both.
And I got to do both, and I worked myself up in that department quite quickly because I was already pre-knowledgeable. I had the stuff that they needed to edit. I mean, we were making concert recordings, albums.
Where were you doing that? I mean, you were going to symphony halls to make them while they were live?
No, this was all in-house, all conservatory stuff. So I was in the little audio department there at the building, recording their concerts, running PA systems, and setting up equipment for famous composers who at that time would come to the conservatory from around the world with their electronic pieces or whatever, audio tape and live music mixed together and that kind of thing. Anything that involved that, they would call in me and the other people I worked with to help them set up. So I was meeting all these famous people and working with them and getting a deeper understanding of music than I would otherwise have had. And I was listening to about 100 concerts a year, more than I would have, because I was recording many of them and so forth. So I did that. And I was actually working almost full-time hours. And this is in a school of music.
While you're going to school,
yeah.
And other things were expected of you.
I think I skipped pretty much sleep and all social activities for 4 years to be able to do this. But I earned enough money to buy myself a car by the time I graduated. So it really did pay off. during the time I was there, I learned what it is to be a musician.
And what is that?
I'm still learning. But what it meant at the time was having a total commitment to something that is really intangible, very abstract. I've discussed this with scientists who, a lot of scientists, you know, they have, for some reason, the attraction to music, and all of them have studied music pretty intensely. And we came to the conclusion that it's really about trying to make something abstract and turn it into something that's real, the extent that you can do it. And this is what you try to do with music.
If math could talk, it would be music.
Yeah, there you go. And so music to me is always about trying to reach something, about trying to get to a certain point, whether it's through a specific piece of music or just to have an understanding about music in general and constantly trying to apply it to the rest of real life. You know, visual artists can do this a little more directly. People see their work. It takes them 3 seconds to look at the canvas or the sculpture, mm-hmm. or whatever, and they see, okay, this is a starting point. With music, it's time-dependent. You have to listen sometimes to all 10 minutes or all 40 minutes or all hour and a half to really get the point.
To get the whole story.
This is why music is a tough art to try to convey and why it's a harder sell to make a living at. And for a long time after I graduated, I was in orchestras and playing chamber music.
Oh, really?
I did a lot of that for 20, 30 years. But underneath all of those typical activities, I had learned to branch off into playing other kinds of music and being a different kind of musician from most of the people I graduated with.
I hope you're going to tell us what.
And the reason is because of the particular person who was an inspiration to me at that school, which was the president of the school at the time, the noted composer and conductor Gunther Schuller. He's one of the most famous people in music, and he's the person I most admire. He's one of these people who literally only gets 4 hours of sleep by his own account a night. And he has every award in the book. He's composed 100 or more very well-known pieces to orchestra and singers and so forth for all kinds of ensembles. He had a MacArthur Foundation grant in recent years, a Pulitzer. He's really recognized as a composer.
So what is it he did for you?
As president of the school, what he did, having worked with him both in the orchestra he conducted at the school and sort of in off hours as I was doing private engineering projects for his recordings, I was meeting him as a staff member, as a student, as a sort of colleague. So I got to know him really well, and I got to really understand what he does and what the nature of his work is. It carried over into me. His philosophy, among many, is be a complete musician. Mm-hmm. He spells that C-O-M-P-L-E-A-T, complete musician. Do more than just play your instrument. Be a musician. Learn about conducting. Learn about composing. Whether you do these things in practice or not, that's not the point. Ethnomusicology, learn of musics from 20 or 30 other countries. We would have courses with him, intense courses on just, you know, an hour on triplets as they are played by 10 different countries on three
continents.
Fabulous. It was a really intense, all-pervasive education, which the message for me was, being a musician isn't just calling yourself a musician, it is being a musician.
Yes.
Everything I do comes out of that. You really are in touch with that. By the time you graduate from this school under his influence, you understand this.
So where did that take you?
Well, what it took me was something he directly did, which I directly followed. I mentioned that I had this experience when I first got there of becoming recruited into the audio department. In my junior year, Schuller, in one of his many extra musical sort of things, put together a concert of American music. I think it was called Romantic American Music. It was a little festival. And in it, he included, for a little ensemble, 4 Joplin rags.
Oh, that's how... Uh-huh.
And I was ushering this concert. And I thought, wow, this is pretty fun stuff. And we did that and sort of forgot about it. The next year, he decided to create a specific ensemble to record 8 of these Joplin rags.
Mm-hmm. This is Scott Joplin.
Now,
Scott Joplin.
Can I just ask you something, just for the sake of our listeners, would you just explain, for the sake of everybody listening, what is a rag? Just can you do that for a minute? Just explain what ragtime actually does to a piece of music?
Well, ragtime and a rag are 2 different things, but ragtime is sort of an art of writing music and playing it, where you have what we call syncopated melodies in the right hand on top of a march-like rhythm in the left hand on a piano. It's piano music primarily. And also carried over into orchestra music and vocal music. But it's the way of playing a melody that has a syncopated style to it over this very steady rhythm in the left hand. Without a piano or something, I can't demonstrate that really fully. But a rag is what Scott Joplin and others around 1900 started composing, specific pieces that use this art to create 3-4 minute works. Rags.
Okay.
With rags in the title and, you know, specifically. Yes. So there are a few thousand of these rags from that period.
And people who've watched The Sting, who've been to the movie The Sting, are familiar with some of Scott's
rags. That is a very good example of those rags. That's right. Although the movie's set in 1936, the music's from 1900, that's okay. So
that's
like
right. So at least it's not the other way around.
Yeah, that's right. So this story actually relates to The Sting a little bit, too. During my senior year, Schuller decided to record these rags. They were drawn from a particular publication. This is really important, because I'm going to tell you a story you will never forget.
Okay.
These rags were drawn from a folio called The Redback Book. Its real name was Standard High Class Rags, but it was published in 1912 by Joplin's publisher. It was a few of these orchestrations put together like a little assorted folio for 11 instruments as a set. Nobody had ever done that, collected orchestrations together, and published them like that, and it hasn't been done since. It's the only one of its kind. All right, so just file that fact away. Now, we record this album. I was one of the engineers on this record, The Redback Book, in my senior year in April. In February, we recorded it. It was released in April. It eventually won a Grammy for chamber music for that year. And in the weekend of graduation, 2 days before graduation, I ushered a concert, the first actual public concert of the New England Conservatory Ragtime Ensemble. And I saw this whole concert with everything they did with this ensemble, their full repertoire, and it went into overtime, there were 4 encores, and it was the most fabulous experience. And this is 2 days before graduation, and I said, that is what I want to do.
Oh, I wondered. Okay.
It's all worked out to me. All right, now, I graduated. The next day, I officially start my group, the American Ragtime Ensemble. By extension, from the New England Ragtime Ensemble, this is my organization. This is what I do.
And you're still in the East here with this?
I moved out.
That's what I want to know.
I moved to a couple of different locations in the country to teach music for a while and teach in public school.
Okay, that's important to know.
Until I sort of got grounded and sort of figured out, you know, I was really going to make a plan to make a living. So I taught school orchestra programs in Minnesota and in Texas. That's 5 years. And then I moved here to San Francisco, and where I've been since. During the time that we did this Redback Book record and it became popular, I started going to ragtime festivals and I became known as a person associated with the Redback Book. This is a really intriguing concept to people who are into this music. So, all right, now skipping many years later, I collect orchestrations, and by the way, this is a hint to your listeners, if they happen to have any orchestrations out there from before 1920, I do like to collect them.
Okay, so where can you be reached for them to...
Through KUSF.
Okay.
Sure. Collected a lot of orchestrations. I have a very large collection that I use with my ensemble, but also as a kind of a curator, a historian, archivist, I have this sort of historic collection. But the Redback Book itself was always kind of a mythical thing. Mm-hmm. What Schuller was using in those recordings was photocopies of a few of the pieces. He never actually saw the actual artifact of the Redback Book. All right. Some years ago, I was in a music store in San Francisco, and this lady who knew I was into ragtime, who's the proprietor, gave me this box. Somebody donated this box of music. You can have it. I don't really want it.
Oh,
in
my
it
goodness.
Are 9 of the 11 part books of the Redback Book, not photocopies, the actual thing. And indeed, they're red, colored, and it fully functioned. I mean, there was nothing wrong with them, not ripped up, not signed, not trimmed off, no marks. It was like they were still being sold in the store from 1912, and this deep red color was still there, not faded. This is the most unbelievable museum-type find I ever encountered. I say, now I have 9 of these. I need 2 more to get the full set. And I did a little horse trading with somebody I knew had a couple of the books. He happened to have the 2 I needed. So I've become only the second person in history now in modern times to have the full, complete set of the Redback Book, a thing which, you know, there might be 5 people in the country would appreciate having this.
I'm just breathless listening to this. I mean, just so it went from, like, concept to reality in your short life.
Yes. And of all the people for that box just to show up in that music store that day, and I happened to be there, and this was, I give talks on this.
So you were there for a reason.
I don't know.
Oh.
I tell you, this is a very good bizarre thing, which makes up for a lot of bad bizarre things happened to me. So that's the outline. But if you wanted to just isolate one inspiring good thing that came out of going to a music school, that would have to be it. Along with, I must say, hundreds of other sort of lesser but important inspirational.
So are you, I'm just curious, are you writing all this down for yourself?
And it has been documented through doing
you.
My radio show and in talks that I give and in pieces I've written for books and magazines.
So you have all this in your hand somehow. Let's talk about your love letter then for a minute.
Yeah.
So it would go to
New England Conservatory.
In the name of, I mean, you need to write it and mail it.
Mm-hmm.
So whose name would be on the envelope?
The president of the school.
Okay, so you know who that is.
Mm-hmm.
And you have an address. I mean, that's really a plus.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take notes for you. And part of, I mean, you may have all this in perfect shape in your head and heart. But
or not.
Or not. Okay, that's what we're after. And so writing a good love letter means putting it all down on paper first, everything you want to say, everything you think you want to say, and then calling or including everything.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that you want the president now to know about how you felt about your time there?
One thing.
And the date's important because that'll be in their archives.
Yeah.
This is your history documented in your own hand.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the primary message I would want to convey is that what is to affirm what they have always said at this school about, you know, the importance of music, what they try to tell their students about the importance of music. At these tough times, economically and otherwise, it seems like such a hopeless aspiration to spend much of your youth practicing an instrument, hoping that you get into one of the few schools of music there is in a slot where there are very few slots available.
It's like Kafka's The Hunger Artist.
And why would you want to do this? Having known, if you graduate with honors, and every award they have, there's still not really going to be a job for you unless you happen to luck out and unless you happen to turn into some fabulous rock star who seems to make all the big bucks these days.
Just a few.
And why do people do this? And there are hundreds of applicants to each school every year, knowing that it's futile in terms of making a living. The reason they do this is because you're just born to do this. You're born to be a musician. You know it. You realize it. And so in my letter, I would just, as I'm sure they get letters like people from this occasionally about this,
mm-hmm.
I would affirm that, yes, these ideals are still important. People who go to that school go because that is what they do best. That is what they want to do. That's all they really want to do, economics or not. And it's important to train them just like they trained us in days when I was there and before I was there. This is the oldest school of music in the country, private school of music in America.
Mm-hmm.
It was founded in 1867. And they've been carrying on this tradition of raising little musicians and turning them out into the world all this time. The hopes of becoming a full-time musician or even a decent part-time musician, decent in terms of amount of time, are pretty slim these days. Orchestras are folding. Chamber music is really hard to sell. There's a real downturn in some parts of the audiences and upturn in other parts of it. But it's not a real viable way to make a living unless you're very, very adaptable. And this is the second part of the message. It is important to keep that flexibility and not just playing.
And they teach this?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
This was the...
being the overall musician.
Yeah, this was the first school of music in the country, and for a long time the only school of music, to offer a degree in jazz. There are a lot of schools that still don't do that. This was Schuller's. One of the first things he did when he got there in 1967, they offered a jazz degree program. So you can see that, you know, that this is not just your strict classical orchestra player.
Mm-hmm.
School. That's a part of it. It's an important part. But it's really about being able to play any kind of music you think is viable in any way that you think you can do it and using any of your musical talents to do other things, the complete musician, like being a historian in music, writing about music, doing radio shows, whatever it is. You use your musical abilities to do whatever you can and whatever is called for that you're up to it. So I've tried to live up to that ideal, and I've done, in my entire life has been about music. I've never done anything that wasn't related to music,
uh-huh.
sometimes a volunteer effort and something outside of music. But as far as a career, I have not really purposefully lived up there. I just naturally like the idea of doing that.
Okay,
and
so
I want them to know that.
That's a really important thing to include, I think. So what you're saying is, say that again, because that was just lovely.
Well, I want to be able to tell the people who now administer New England Conservatory that, yes, I affirm their ideals that they've always had in the school, to encourage the students to think very broadly about their music education,
make use
of every talent.
Yes, but you just said that you did it more or less because that was you.
Yeah, and I knew that going in. When I look back, I now know that when I was a youth, before I ever thought about going to music school, yes, of course, what else would I do? I would be a musician, and I would have an interest in many different kinds of music, but I would concentrate on one instrument. This is a mistake some people seem to make is, well, the idea of being a broad musician means you learn every instrument there is. And that is not always the case. There are a few people who can do that. But I think it's more important to be able to play one instrument really well and do a variety of things with it or with the knowledge about music in the background. I have a very deep knowledge of theory and counterpoint and all the technical things and history and ethnomusicology and many of the subjects that are taught in the school, but I have accumulated a lot more knowledge, having graduated, but still thinking like that. I hear something on TV or on the radio or live music, sometimes sitting here in the studio, in the next studio there'll be some band coming in here at KUSF. My ears open. Most people try to block out sound. It's really hard for me to block out sound.
Yeah, me too. I have a thing about background music.
It
takes all your energy.
I was trained my entire life to listen. I listen right now. I hear four or five different layers of sound as we're sitting in this room. Some of them are outside. And if I were a composer, primarily, I would be thinking, gee, the rustle of the air out there and the leaves and the background and stuff, there's an interesting compositional idea or something like that. I'm not a composer. Well, I have composed, but I'm not really a composer, so to speak. But as a musician, I just pay attention to sounds. So it's just a total kind of being aware of things, especially about music, especially about ideas of music. And when a few pieces that I've composed, I try to do that from the inside. I don't try to steal other ideas and make them, you know, part of my own compositional idea. I try to organically make it from the inside.
So you're happy with your life?
Well, now we go with a different question.
Okay.
given all that I've said, we're talking about the ideals and the whole spirit of the thing and you know, what we try to do, and as a musician, having made a career in music. On the other hand, to be perfectly honest, except for the 5 years when I was employed full-time as a teacher, during the period I was growing up, my family, our income was below the poverty line. Mm-hmm. We didn't live in poverty, but, you know, we're just very, very meager incomes, my parents. And since, and while I was at school, and then after I stopped teaching full-time, since I've been a career violinist, my income has always been below the poverty line. I mean, I don't have any hopes.
So that part of life is difficult.
It's extremely difficult.
Right, but I'm talking about what you've accomplished and who you are that's been polished by these people.
Yeah, I'm perfectly happy with that.
That's what I mean. Yes, of course.
But yeah, it's always tinged with this background and surrounded by a couple of things, not just economically. The second negative in life is that the appreciation for what musicians do in some sectors of life has gone down a whole lot. For example, not to give you too many horror stories, but as part of my work, I'm a contractor of musicians.
Mm-hmm.
I don't just wait for the phone to ring. Somebody calls up and says, hey, I got a band I need you to play. I go find work, and
well,
I go find
you.
The musicians, usually my own core group of musicians. I say, well, I have a job. And I talk to the clients. I'm the person who sets it up. I'm the contractor. It's getting harder and harder to find people who want to hire live musicians.
Sure.
And frankly, people under 30 are astonished now at the idea. Why would you hire live music?
Because chamber music concerts at home are not, yes.
Well, even having live music, even having music for a public event, you know, a store opening or a company party, whatever it is, they can just turn on, they can get a disc. And the second thing is, a lot of musicians' work comes from weddings and things like that.
Yes.
Well, it used to be you played the ceremony and, you know, the processional and the reception. Then it became a lot of brides or a lot of brides' fathers, whoever's paying for it, would have the receptions DJ'd.
Right.
So the live musicians would play the ceremony.
Right.
Now, we don't even get the ceremony jobs because these brides can download the disc exactly timed to their ceremony. They don't need the live musician
at
all. They can get any music they want. on that disc. Technology is a good thing, but it's kind of killed some of our business.
Okay.
So that's a couple of examples of the background of which I'm working against here. But overall, to answer your question,
I'm so thrilled to know all this. I listen to your show every Monday.
Thank you.
To know who's the man behind it is really been lovely for me personally. I know this isn't about me, but it's been great.
Well, I'm glad you're out here.
Thank you. I do. I love it a lot. So usually we talk a lot about love letters really having to be in your own handwriting, but you've got so much to say. I can see that this could be a really long piece, and I don't know whether you feel like doing it in your own handwriting, which I think looks really good in the archives 150 years from now.
I'm one of the last people who still writes handwritten letters.
Oh, perfect.
I don't even own a computer, so
okay.
I don't do computer.
Then I don't have to even talk about this anymore. Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for doing this with us.
You're welcome.
Do you have a... You don't have a computer, you probably don't have a website.
I don't have a website.
But if people want to talk to David about anything, you can call the KUSF studio and get a message to him. Is that right?
For me, sure.
Yes, okay.
Should we give him the phone number?
Yes, go ahead.
It's 415-386-6469.
Thank you.
Excuse me, wrong number.
Erase that.
I was thinking about something else. Erase that, 386-5873. There's your number.
Say the whole thing in a row.
415-386-5873.
Thank you. You know, websites like phone numbers, if you miss one letter or digit, they'll never find you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much. I've been educated as well, and I do love
I've got a million more questions. Yes. I wish this were not only an hour show, but that it were television so people could see your face as you're even talking about this.
Just one last question, David. Yes. Are musicians born or made?
Most of them, of the good ones, are born. A few of the lucky ones are made, and all the rest of them have it poured on them by somebody else who wants them to be a musician. Yeah.
But, I was going to ask a similar question if we have time, because you said you chose it arbitrarily in grammar school. But if you didn't have something in you, you wouldn't have done this. So to say you chose it arbitrarily, there was something pulling you.
I think mostly I was referring to when the list came around, it was a list of instruments.
Which instrument? Yeah.
Arbitrarily. So, okay, violin.
Okay.
Good. Yeah.
Because the rest of it was clearly in you from...
Right.
Oh, yeah, they would have had me in an orchestra one way or the other.
Right. Okay.
Wouldn't keep me out.
Music chose you.
Yeah, maybe you could put it that way. Yeah.
Yes. Well, again, thank you.
And thank you to all of our listeners. Again, this is Love Letters Live. We're here every week at this time. Hope you will join us. We also have a website if you'd like to know more about love letters. Our website is...
LoveLettersQuad.com. And please remember that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is a special occasion, and you can tie it into your own history meant for someone's archives.
So we hope you'll write that letter now, while you still have the chance.
Yes.
So till next time, this is Teresa.
And Janet.
Saying bye-bye.
Bye.